Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Secure Freedom Radio. It's Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney yet again. Much to talk about tonight as well as every night. And don't forget, we are tracking the nominations of the potential Secretary of State, i.e. Senator John Kerry, Secretary of Defense nominee Chuck Hagel, and CIA Director John Brennan. And we want to get your opinion as well. We have a hotline set up. If you have questions for any of these individuals, please call 800-332-7131. Leave your question, and we will use it later on the radio. And speaking of Chuck Hagel and the Secretary of Defense and defense in general, no better person to talk to than Rebecca Heinrichs, who is a nuclear defense and security expert, currently a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, previously a military legislative assistant to House member of the Armed Services Committee, Trent Franks, and the former manager of the House Bipartisan Missile Defense Caucus. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, I don't know how happy I am when I read the material you just put out in the Daily Caller about this Global Zero U.S. Nuclear Policy Commission, something that came out last May, calling for draconian cuts in the nuclear arsenal. My understanding is the putative Secretary of Defense was one of the authors of this report. What does it say about missile defense going forward if he gets the nod?
Yeah, a couple things. The Global Zero Commission put out this report in May of last year. Former Senator Chuck Hagel was one of the co-authors. It's a very radical report. This isn't just your run-of-the-mill, we should have fewer nuclear weapons. This is, we should have 450 deployed, only 900 total. We should get rid of our ICBM legs of the nuclear triad, which Republican and Democrat administrations for the last several decades have agreed we need it. The report has just, it's incredibly radical. The current person who's in charge of our strategic forces, General Kaler, has actually denounced the report as something that just doesn't make sense for our current national security. And then Senator Chuck Hagel agreed to sign on to this report. He's a co-author, and now he's up to be the next Secretary of Defense. So it's quite alarming.
Well, and not only that, but let's assume he's confirmed, and I would have to guess right now the odds are in his favor. What does that say about this administration's posture towards nuclear defense going forward?
Well, this administration has been incredibly coy with the Senate, and I would say outright dishonest. They agreed in order to sign, the Senate agreed in order to approve the New START treaty, which agreed to further nuclear reductions of the United States arsenal in agreement with Russia and then their forces, that we would get money to modernize our nuclear weapons. We have nuclear weapons that are aging, and frankly, they're not in good shape at all. And if we're going to go to fewer numbers, we at least have to make sure the ones we have are in good shape. The president promised that he would do so. He'd put money into modernizing our forces, and he failed to do so. He completely reneged. So now we're left with a force that we're actually shrinking, and we're not testing it, and we're not modernizing it. Every other nuclear power in the world is modernizing and upgrading their nuclear weapons, including countries like North Korea, Russia, China, and of course we know that Iran is in pursuit of a nuclear weapons capability themselves.
Well, then let me ask you something, because you made a point in your Daily Caller article that I wanted to expand on a little bit. Apparently in this report, there's a statement that says security is a state of mind, not necessarily a physical condition. Well, if that's true, whose state of mind are we talking about, the United States or our enemies?
That's probably one of the most alarming things about the report, in my opinion, is that aside from the conclusions they come to, the underlying premises in which they develop the argument, the authors of the Global Zero Report, they made such a statement that, like you said, security is a state of mind. In other words, it's not bombs that provide security, it's not armor, it's not bullets, it's not guns, it's just a state of mind. And it's a very liberal understanding of the world and the way the world works. So it is peculiar. I'm not even completely sure what they mean by that, other than that I know that American military power has preserved peace and deterred war for years, and that the stronger the United States is, the more stable the world is. And to say that the world would be safer if the United States is weaker is simply just a false proposition.
Well, even if we were not having this discussion about whether or not Chuck Hagel will attempt to dismantle our nuclear capabilities, what is the status of the U.S. nuclear force and its development or lack thereof if the sequestration cuts go through as predicted?
Well, sequestration is just, it's a horrific thought, and it looks like we have the military actually now bracing for sequestration. Now, sequestration, of course, would be a $500 billion cut to the Pentagon over the next 10 years, and it would be equal. Supposedly, it's equal, so it's across the board, which means that no program would be exempt, which means our nuclear forces would not be exempt, which means our missile defenses would not be exempt. So there's all of these programs that we need now more than ever as the world becomes more dangerous and more unpredictable. We need these things. So sequestration would be devastating. It would be devastating to the Pentagon. It would certainly be devastating to our nuclear forces. But to be honest, the president hasn't shown any evidence of actually supporting strong modernization efforts for nuclear forces anyway, even if we didn't have sequestration.
But quite to the contrary, it seems like sequestration is hand in glove with this Global Zero report we just got done talking about. Because if you're correct and they're actually thinking about getting rid of two legs of the triad, the ICBMs and the B-52 bombers, then sequestration is the means to that end, is it not?
Well, exactly. I mean, I guess my point would just be that regardless of sequestration, it looks like the administration is not willing to modernize our forces or put their money where their mouth is, which is to say that modernization would be in danger anyway. But with sequestration, it gives them an excuse to cut even further and to fail to live up to the promise to modernize our forces.
Okay, well, let's go back to something you were talking about earlier when you referred to North Korea, one of those nations that is bent on improving its nuclear capability. While they're developing their nuclear capability, Israel is developing the Iron Dome, is obviously working day and night on their missile defense. Shouldn't we be learning lessons from countries like Israel rather than reading reports like the Ground Zero U.S. Nuclear Policy Commission?
Absolutely. I keep trying to tell people that you look to Israel. Israel doesn't worry about the controversy or the politics surrounding missile defense like Americans do. Americans have this sort of love-hate relationship with missile defense. You take polls, the American people generally support missile defense, but when you come into the Congress, you've got lots of folks that oppose missile defense for a couple of reasons. One is just ideologically they're opposed to it because it was a brainchild of Ronald Reagan. And two, they believe that it's destabilizing because if the United States builds up our defenses, it might create an incentive for the bad guys to build up their offenses. But then you have Israel, who is in a life and death situation every day, and they have built up this wonderful system. It's technologically marvelous. And even during this last conflict with Hamas, they were able to defend themselves and protect the Israelis. I'm very encouraged with some of the comments, though, that have come out of the Senate from the success the Israelis have. We have just recently Senator Rand Paul, who has not been the warmest towards a very strong
Hardly.
And robust defense budget. But Senator Rand Paul went to Israel, and he came back and he said, you know what? I don't understand why the United States wouldn't have a similar system to protect D.C. and major cities from incoming missiles.
And as you point out, we don't have that system right now. We've only got two installations, one in California and one in Alaska. That hardly protects a country the size of the U.S.
Well, we have a layered system. So we have multiple programs that are deployed to defend against different kinds of missiles that are coming towards the United States or our allies. But you're correct in that we have two installations that currently protect the United States from long-range ballistic missiles. Mainly, that would come from North Korea. Whenever we deployed them, that was the threat we were concerned about. But it's limited. Limited meaning it only can intercept a handful of missiles that a rogue country like North Korea would have, and it protects the West Coast pretty well from a threat from North Korea. Problem is, it's got the East Coast too, and that is where missiles from Iran would be towards the East Coast of the United States. And those two installations we have don't provide the optimal protection from an ICBM threat from Iran. And our current system certainly doesn't protect the United States from a threat that a country like Russia or China would be able to pose to the United States should they become in a position to pose that kind of threat.
Well, Rebecca, as you may have heard at the beginning of this program, I left a number for people to call in, perhaps pose questions to Secretary Designate Hagel. But you've left a long list of questions I would love to ask if I were on that committee. I just hope that somebody is listening to this program or reading your article and can put these questions to Secretary Hagel, because I think it's important no matter who the next Secretary of Defense is. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Rebecca Heinrichs, currently at the Heritage Foundation, and we will be back right after these messages.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC, New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney. And, of course, one of the topics we keep our eye on regularly is the plight of Syria, and particularly the plight of religious minorities and Christians in Syria. No better person to talk to than Dr. Patrick Sukdeo on this subject. He is the founder and international director of the Barnabas Fund, an organization that is dedicated to helping Christian communities around the world who are being persecuted. His latest book, in conjunction with Katie Gorka, is called Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. And Dr. Sukdeo will be at the Westminster Institute in McLean, Virginia, this coming Tuesday, the 23rd of January, to deliver a talk on Syria, learning the lessons of Iraq. He joins us from England. Dr. Sukdeo, thanks for being with us. Without trying to steal too much thunder, can you give us an idea of what some of those lessons from Iraq are?
Yes, and thank you so much for having me on your program. Looking at, you could say, since 9/11, which we all know was a dreadful attack on the U.S. by terrorists, by religious terrorist groups. What we have seen, particularly in the Middle East, but also in South Asia, have been a series of conflicts, wars, in which the West have deployed forces to combat the terrorists and others. Sadly, one of those areas was Iraq, and the jury is still out as to how far the Iraq war was valid. But whatever we think of the rights and wrong of the Iraq war, one of the results of that war was the effect it had on minorities. The U.S., the U.K., and coalition forces did not protect the minorities. With the result, the minorities went to the wall, in particular the Christian communities. And one of the oldest churches in the world was effectively decimated. The U.S. and coalition forces found it very difficult to protect the minorities. When it came to the political, they were virtually written out of the constitution. Now you have an independent Iraqi state. There is no protection afforded for the Christians. And so a community of 1.5 million was decimated to a few hundred thousand. So one lesson we have now to learn for Syria, as we are about to engage in a new conflict, is what's going to happen to the minorities.
Well, let me ask you something about the potential for persecution after Bashar Assad, who, regardless of whether the U.S. gets involved or not, is probably on his way out. What kind of future can Christian minorities and other religious minorities expect if Syria gets new leadership, possibly a coalition of factions of the Muslim Brotherhood?
You see, it's rather interesting that neither Saddam Hussein in Iraq nor Bashar Assad persecuted Christians. They were dictators, but they did not persecute Christian minorities. And the reason was that Christians tend to be apolitical. They don't like to get into trouble, and they're generally trusted. Now, Syria, of all Middle Eastern countries, was the freest for Christian communities. It was the stablest. They had human rights, full human rights. They had religious freedoms. In fact, the government actually paid for the electricity and heating of churches. So the churches, the government actually welcomed churches and Christians and treated them in a way which no other Middle Eastern government has actually done. What we have seen now in this conflict, and you could call it since the so-called Arab Spring, which has actually turned out to be an Islamist spring, is the role of Qatar and Saudi Arabia that have been orchestrating conflicts on the ground, whether it be Libya, whether it be Egypt, whether it be Tunisia, you have the same pattern. Now, it was the Muslim Brotherhood of Qatar and the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia that began to orchestrate the conflicts within Syria. I think the government of Syria found themselves in real difficulties to know how to respond. But whatever we think of their responses, rights or wrongs, one of the key elements is what will happen to the minorities, the Shia, the Jews, and in particular, the Christians. The Christians now are being hammered.
To that end, obviously, this is something that you have devoted your life's work to, and your foundation is committed to that. But I have to tell you, as somebody who has been in public policy in the United States, I have not seen the plight of religious minorities to be a top priority for the United States, either in Iraq, certainly in Egypt, with the Coptic Christians now under assault, and the minorities you refer to in Syria. I'm curious, what is the policy in the UK? Are they looking the other way when it comes to these minorities as well?
I would argue it's exactly the same as the US. If I may give you an illustration, if you take Nigeria, the Boko Haram, which is a terrorist Islamist group in the north, they've killed over 10,000 Christians. The US government is divided over it. State Department says they're a justifiable liberation movement after the pattern of the Arab Spring. The Justice Department says they're a terrorist group and so should be proscribed. The UK government do not see them as a terrorist group. So what we have got are our Western governments, particularly your own and my own, that are very much in league with the Islamists, whether it be the Muslim Brotherhood of Qatar or whether it be the Wahhabis of and Salafis of Saudi. And this new axis which has been formed now has begun to reshape Western government policies. So when you now look at religious minorities and Christians, they are effectively expendable. A top diplomat said this to me in the UK. He says, you can't make omelets without breaking eggs. In this case, if the eggs are Christians in Syria or elsewhere, well, if they go toward the wall, well, it's a necessary process if it could lead to stable Middle Eastern states.
Well, that would be a stable Middle Eastern state, though, without any kind of minority protection at all, for certainly for Christian minorities, and probably extended persecution.
Exactly, which is what we've got now in Egypt. So you've got a stable state, so-called, under the Muslim Brotherhood, but which is now suppressing the Christian communities. And I fear what will happen, not just in the Middle East, but across the Islamic world, is the West, in pursuit of stability now, will back the Islamists. Those who suffer most will be the Christians and other minorities, and they will be guarded as the eggs that needs to be broken to make this omelet.
Let me ask you something. As somebody who was born in Guyana, then British Guyana, and of course moved to the United Kingdom, I would assume, like many other people who have left those parts of the world because of freedoms and liberties and individual protections, and two countries, the U.S. and the U.K., that have at least for a long time been champions of human rights, it looks as though we're entering an era now where human rights is more of a nuisance than a right that we will champion around the world. Are you getting that impression as well?
I'm getting that impression, but I think I would reword it slightly differently. I would say not just human rights, but religious liberty. I think this is where the fundamental problem is. My father fought the British for freedom. When we came to Britain, freedom was paramount, liberty, liberty of conscience. Now, the principles on which the US and the UK were built on, which is liberty, freedom of conscience, the right of belief, is being sacrificed. If I may give you one illustration, both your government and mine have begun to use the phrase recently of freedom of worship. When we come to look at religious freedom includes freedom to propagate your beliefs, freedom to change your beliefs, not just freedom to worship. And I think this redefinition means that the US and UK government is effectively changing the terms of the UN articles on their fundamental freedoms. And my concern is that the U.S. is no longer committed to religious freedom, although, if I must say so, very recently, I think it's Senator Wolf, has just created a grouping within your government to ensure the freedom of religious minorities. So it may well be that there is a swing away from the old position towards actually rectifying it, but I can't say that for certain.
Well, Dr. Sugaya, we're going to have to leave it there. I'll just say in closing, I served with Frank Wolf in the House of Representatives, and there's not a greater gladiator for religious freedom in the world, but I have to tell you quite honestly, he is a tiny minority within a very large government. He does speak out, but the problem is not what he says, it's the number of people who listen. We've been talking with Dr. Patrick Sugdeo, the founder and international director of the Barnabas Fund. He will be here next week, this Tuesday, to speak at the Westminster Institute. Dr. Sugdeo, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
And thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back right after these words.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Sanger.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feed the pig!
www.accountantsinstitute.org. This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama wants Chuck Hagel as the next defense secretary. One reason, the former Nebraska senator is willing to cut even more from the Pentagon budget than Mr. Obama has publicly advocated to date. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are so alarmed at the impact of the cuts already in prospect that they've issued a written warning to Congress. They said the United States military was reaching the tipping point that would produce a hollow force. Civilian control of the U.S. Armed Forces is an important and time-honored principle in this country. If senators give Chuck Hagel that control, though, they will assure the hollowing out of our military. History shows that that will make the world more dangerous and make the men and women charged with protecting us ever less capable of doing so. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney, who joins us now in San Antonio. I believe you're patrolling the southern perimeter today, are you not, Frank?
We're down on the border, yes, sir.
All right, okay. Well, speaking of borders, forget Texas and Mexico for a minute, but I did want to talk about perhaps the border between Algeria and Mali and the border between Algeria and Libya, because once again, although the reports of how many hostages and how many terrorists have either been freed or killed, it looks as though Al-Qaeda is once again not on the ropes, as the Obama administration would have us believe, but very much on the rise.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't seem to be on the path to defeat, that's for sure.
No.
And the representations that it was, of course, Fred, were fraudulent whenever they were made, before the election, subsequent to the election. And the thing that is so important here, it seems to me, is connecting the dots between the evidence that it was never true and the fact that the president perpetrated, really, what I consider national security fraud in saying otherwise. Let's start with Libya, of course. The president got involved, albeit leading from behind, but nonetheless was very much involved in the liberation of Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, which in practice turned the place over to Islamists, including Al-Qaeda elements. Some of the arms from his immense weapons caches have clearly migrated all over the place, not least into Mali. And in Mali, we have now an Al-Qaeda-dominated, vast territory, the size of France, some say it's the size of Texas, whatever it is, it's a lot of country. And we've now got the evidence that in any effort to respond to that threat, and it is a threat, no question about it, we're going to find al-Qaeda elements and probably other jihadists striking back. And that seems to be what's been going on in Algeria of late. And the full, as you say, death count or the status of these hostages is still unclear as we speak, but it's evidence of a problem that I think we're going to find much more of in the future, namely not only an al-Qaeda and other jihadist community that is emboldened by what they perceive as our weakness and a diminishing capability on our part to contend with such threats in Mali, in Algeria, in elsewhere in North Africa, in the Middle East more generally, and perhaps elsewhere around the world as well.
Well, you know, talking about connecting the dots, obviously, I get the impression that certainly the Muslim Brotherhood and its advance guard, al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Sharia, take your pick, is much better at connecting the dots than are we. Obviously, they're looking at a battle over defense cuts, sequestration, whether or not to get involved in Syria, which I'm sure we will not do at the expense of Christian minorities. And they must be saying to themselves, why not advance right now? And obviously, with a possibility of taking northern Mali, with the real prize being southern Mali, and Mali being preciously close to Europe as a potential place to launch missiles, I'm really surprised that we're spending so much time wondering about why they would have attacked this natural gas facility in Algeria when I think the answer is, why wouldn't you?
The trouble with our underestimating, as the Obama administration has done, and I think most especially that's been done by John Brennan, our Homeland Security Advisor and President Obama's choice to become the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. If ever there were a person who should be disqualified from being in charge of our intelligence services, it would be somebody who has demonstrated such utter malfeasance in his previous post. But here we are with us having failed to assess adequately the nature of the Islamist threat, let alone the extent to which we are emboldening it, as I said, by our weakness, by our efforts to appease them. And most especially, Fred, as you know so well, you've got to start with the doctrine that these guys adhere to. They call it Sharia. And when, as you know, when you as a Sharia-adherent Muslim see your enemy, the infidel most especially, engaging in what you can rightly perceive as submissive behavior, you are obliged by your doctrine of Sharia to redouble your effort to make them feel subdued, as it says in the Quran. And that's, I think, what we're seeing happening, again, not just in Algeria, but a lot of places around the world. And we better buckle our seatbelts because we're in for a very rough ride as that kind of perception and that kind of doctrinally driven response to it becomes more manifest elsewhere as well.
Well, speaking of perception, you're probably aware that earlier this week, Senator John McCain and I believe Senator Lindsey Graham and a couple of other members of the Senate were in Egypt, supposedly to confer with President Morsi, and a quick press conference ensued after the meeting. And McCain essentially said, well, as upset and outraged as I was by President Morsi's previous comments about Jews and Christians being apes and pigs and his attack on Zionists, we still feel he's very much entitled to the $480 million that we are proposing to send him as part of our aid package. And I guess I would have to say, as much as I agree with you about the Obama administration, I'm just wondering where the real enemies of al-Qaeda are in the United States Senate, and for that matter, the House of Representatives. If we don't get somebody to stand up, I don't see why al-Qaeda won't sweep all the way across North Africa.
Well, I've known Senator McCain a long time, Fred, and I think that what we've been witnessing in this episode, as in quite a number of others, notably his vicious attack on the Senate floor of Michelle Bachmann, by name, July, over her correct assessment of the Islamist threat and the degree to which our own government is failing to understand it and making a dot connecting to the possibility, just the possibility, that Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated individuals inside our government may be having something to do with our blindness or at least our very defective policies towards these guys. And Fred, the thing is that when you hear Senator McCain denouncing Michelle Bachmann or embracing the Muslim Brotherhood or the legitimacy of continuing to send hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to Mohamed Morsi, a Muslim brother in Egypt's presidency at the moment, or perhaps even in favor of arming these guys. I think it bespeaks his lack of clarity about this threat, and particularly the fact that he's been associated for many years with something called the International Republican Institute, which he chairs, a government underwritten operation that I think has been getting this dreadfully wrong for some time, as was the president before President Obama, President Bush, who thought as long as we could just promote democracy and get a bunch of votes, this is all going to work out swimmingly. It won't. It can't.
Well, unfortunately, I think that, plus something that I perceived when I was in the House for 8 years that continues with members the longer they stay, is a kind of what I would call crippling collegiality. They spend so much time talking to each other and trying to reconcile differences that sometimes that kind of, for want of a better term, buddy system among people who are ideologically opposed gets in the way of making prudent judgments, even when not just words like Morsi, but deeds like what's going on in Mali or Algeria or Boko Haram in Nigeria tell you that this is a full-throated assault against the West and particularly Christianity.
Well, I don't know where that collegiality was when Senator McCain tore into Michelle Bachmann, but I think you're right. You obviously know the Congress far better than I, and there is a penchant there. But what we've got to be talking about, and I think you correctly suggested a moment ago, is are we going to find in time leaders, and I happen to think Michelle Bachmann is one of them, Trent Franks of Arizona, Louis Gohmert of Texas are others, who will stand up, and hopefully some counterparts in the Senate, and say, particularly in the context of John Brennan's confirmation hearings, that what he is doing, what he has been doing, disqualifies him from being in senior government positions going forward. We cannot persist, and we cannot compound the danger that we've been, I think, running already by misunderstanding this jihadist impulse. It's not about personal struggle, Fred, as you know. It is about conquest, military conquest, civilization jihad, if violence is not practicable. But either way, any other portrayal of it, let alone predicating your national security policies on a benign attitude towards these guys, is so fraught with peril that, as I say, I think it disqualifies him from being this director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, of course, as you know, Frank, time's of the essence. Kerry's hearing is on the 24th next week. Hagel's hearing is on the 31st a week later, and then Brennan comes a week after that. So if there is time, we have to make use of it to make sure that the right questions are posed to these guys, and even if they squirm, they are forced to make those answers. And I know that's something that we're dedicated to doing here. We're going to have to leave it there. Frank, good luck in San Antonio protecting the perimeter, and we will be right back with Bill Gertz after these messages.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the Southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to
the Gospel. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today. It being Friday, we're always happy to welcome our regular guest, Bill Gertz, the Washington Times National Security Editor, the senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon, his Inside the Ring column you probably read every week, the best place to go about news for the Pentagon and national security. His latest book, The Failure Factory, How Unelected Bureaucrats Are Undermining U.S. Security. Bill, you got to be updating chapters to that right now based on what we're learning.
Yes, it's certainly an ongoing story.
Yeah, and to that end, there are a couple of stories I wanted to get to, but seeing as how we are about 2 weeks away from Chuck Hagel standing and delivering on becoming the next Secretary of Defense, I haven't had a chance to talk to you about your impressions of why this nomination and whether or not this is a good national security move by this administration.
Yeah, very bad choice for Defense Secretary. It's clear to me and to many other critics that he is just not up to the job of really putting American security first. And by that, I would look at his record on nuclear weapons. This, to me, is the most troubling aspect. He has been a big proponent of the global zero approach to nuclear weapons. And he was on a commission that was headed by a former General Cartwright that really made some radical recommendations for cutting U.S. nuclear forces. And this is most troubling because it comes at a time when you have have both Russia and China in the midst of a major strategic nuclear forces buildup. And then, of course, there's his positions on Iran, which are very weak. And, you know, I think it was Don Rumsfeld, the former defense secretary, who said weakness is provocative. And his is a policy of advocating weakness for the U.S., this idea that if we were to just talk to these adversaries, that this would somehow alleviate the strategic threats that they pose. So,
you know,
in a nutshell, that's the Hegel opposition.
But, you know, Bill, you've been covering this beat for so long, and you've seen guys like Chuck Hagel come and go. And I'm just curious, why do so many members get infected with this virus that allows them to accept things like Global Zero, which is essentially a euphemism for unilateral disarmament? What kind of counsels do they take that influence them after a while to think that the United States can weaken itself and in so doing gain more friends than enemies?
I call it kind of the arms control first syndrome. By that, I mean a lot of the elites in our foreign policy establishment have this kind of naive notion that if we can just enter this process of arms talks and negotiations, and that this is the solution to providing the basis for national security. And it's fundamentally flawed, in my view. You know, the Center for Security Policy has been the advocate of peace through strength, and that is really what is so urgently needed for U.S. national security. And diametrically opposed to peace through strength is this notion of arms control first.
But doesn't, I mean, again, I served in the House for 8 years, and I had some notions about nuclear disarmament when I arrived, but reality intruded. And I was there at a time, really, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and a lot of our strength measures, peace through strength, were paying dividends. I thought there were a lot of lessons to be learned from that, but evidently we've got a new generation of lawmakers that missed the point entirely.
Yes, and I think coupled with that is certainly the fiscal crisis that the country's been facing. You know, the government is basically bankrupt, so a lot of people are kind of giving up the notion of foreign threats, really not fully understanding the nature of the foreign strategic threats facing the country. I think that's really a big problem, especially in Congress. A lot of the members don't really get that.
Well, it seems that there's a new strategy emerging that apparently a nuclear strategy for the United States is more about mollifying Russia and China than it is about preparing a defense. And to that end, I wanted to go to a story that you've been working on about China upgrading its subway and mass transit system to withstand nuclear blasts and possible chemical attacks. Now, you have to ask yourself, if China is a peaceful nation, where would those threats be coming from? Or is this in many ways an attempt by them to upgrade their own military capabilities, both conventional and nuclear?
Yes. Clearly, the Chinese are in the midst of a major strategic nuclear buildup. And the fact that they are strengthening and hardening their subways to make them strengthened against a nuclear attack shows that they're preparing for some type of future conflict. Now, with the United States, clearly the Chinese and all of their military writings identify the U.S. as the main enemy, just like the old Soviet Union. They are taking their forces to new levels, especially their strategic forces, and they refuse to engage in any kind of discussions with the U.S. as to why they are doing that. You know, we have our military exchange programs with
right.
the Chinese, and one of the top questions they have: why are you building up your nuclear forces? And the answer is quite simple. They see us as the enemy, they see us as a threat, and they want to develop nuclear weapons for not just for deterrence purposes, but for actual use. The only reason to develop those type of civil defenses by subways, and they've done this in several cities, and this is fairly recently, is because they are preparing for some type of future conflict with the U.S.
Is that why they're developing an anti-satellite system right now, conducting ASAT tests? Because I never thought that was a defensive weapon. I thought that was a space weapon.
Well, clearly that is part of their strategic forces buildup. They use an asymmetric approach. They're not going to try to match us missile for missile or ballistic missile submarine to ballistic missile submarine. What they're doing is developing these niche forces, and ASAT weapons are part of that. There's been some recent intelligence that they're getting ready to conduct another potentially destabilizing anti-satellite test. This is something that the U.S. military has been fearing for quite some time now. They've done war games with the Chinese, and one of the opening salvos in those simulations is that the Chinese will fire off some 24 anti-satellite missiles and basically put the U.S. military out of business in terms of being able to communicate with forces, to navigate weapons systems, and to gather intelligence. So they're moving on in that direction, and there are some signs that they're getting ready for not just a low Earth orbit test, which they did in 2007, but this would be a new capability of high Earth orbit, capable of attacking our GPS satellites and our intelligence satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit.
All right. Pursuing Don Rumsfeld's comment about weakness being provocative, I wanted to turn to your piece about an Iranian threat escalating, talking about perhaps the Iranian Republican Guard trying to initiate a new round of kidnappings. Now, in light of what we're seeing in Algeria right now, I don't know if those are connected, but they certainly are connected by a perception both in Iran and obviously in the rest of the Muslim world that we are weak and not able to respond to these kinds of provocative events.
Yes, this is a new intelligence threat that's recently been reported, that basically the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps has decided to try and revert back to the period between 1982 and 92 when they took a number of U.S. hostages,
sure.
A number of high-profile cases back then. And again, the motivation was to try to influence U.S. policy. And in this case, they're doing it because of pressure on Iran through sanctions on its nuclear program, as well as Iran's efforts to try and salvage the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria, which is on the ropes. So it's a very troubling development. They've sent out word that the IRGC is looking to kidnap foreign diplomats, especially U.S. diplomats, throughout the Middle East, and possibly using, again, Hezbollah, the terrorist group in Lebanon, as a proxy force for that.
All right. Well, then, in the time we have remaining, seeing as how you brought up the whole subject of intelligence, what is your take on the putative new director of the CIA, John Brennan?
John Brennan is not the right choice. I had a piece in my column recently that the acting director, Mike Morrell, cheered the selection of Brennan as one of our own. In other words, he represents the entrenched CIA bureaucracy at McLean, at the headquarters there. And by that I mean that he is someone who is not going to press forward the needed reforms that are urgently required for the United States to have a very successful intelligence program. We have severe weaknesses in our intelligence. I think Iran is one area where we really lack good intelligence on what's going on with that nuclear program. And of course, China is another area that we need to massively build up our intelligence capabilities to be able to find out things like why the Chinese are strengthening and hardening their subways against nuclear attack, and what types of new missiles they're fielding and what types of new nuclear weapons they're developing. So that's really what's needed. And John Brennan, I can't see him bringing that to the CIA. He's, again, a career bureaucrat there, very weak on the Islamist threat. He's the one that has been advocating not calling jihadists
right.
Islamic. And this has really been a strategic failure to understand the nature of the enemy, as I'm sure you're very aware.
What's your over and under on whether he gets confirmed or not?
My guess right now is that he will probably be confirmed, just because I didn't think that there's enough of an opposition in the Senate to that nomination.
I'm afraid you're right. Bill, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Bill Gertz of the Washington Times and the Washington Free Beacon. And Frank will be back on Monday. Until then, Fred Grandy saying stay safe.